Welcome to PostStatus Draft, the official podcast for PostStatus, a website with news and information for WordPress professionals. Today, Joe and I discuss scaling WordPress and the things that you need to be on the lookout for and some ways to mitigate scaling issues with WordPress. If you enjoy this podcast, you can get a lot more quality news and analysis from the PostStatus Club multiple times per week. Check out our current club members, site partners, and join the club on our website at poststatus.com/club. You'll be joining more than 650 wonderful club members, and you'll never miss important WordPress news again. Today, I'd like to feature one of our partners, iThemes. iThemes has a full suite of excellent products to help you level up your WordPress website. From iThemes security to Backup Buddy's new live backups to Exchange for your next membership website, iThemes has you covered. Go to iThemes.com for more information, and thanks to the team at iThemes for being a PostStatus partner. Now here's our show. Hey, everybody. I'm Brian, and I'm the editor of PostStatus.
And I'm Joe, a co-founder and the CTO of HumanMade. And welcome to the PostStatus Draft podcast. And today we're going to discuss scaling WordPress and what to do when you think you might have reached WordPress's limits.
Yeah, so in the past 24 hours, I've heard two stories that were a little bit depressing about highly successful websites that were leaving WordPress because they had felt that they reached the limits of what they could do with WordPress. And I thought it'd be interesting to talk about some of the things that you might run into in terms of trying to scale WordPress. And that's anywhere from a data standpoint to a traffic standpoint. And obviously, Joe, you got a lot of experience with this.
I guess I feel like I got a lot of experience with fixing issues that I've run into. So
yeah, people that are already in this situation and trying to figure out how best to mitigate.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's certainly I think when you take just WordPress as it is, then it's fairly unconfigured. I guess is the best way to put it for maybe kind of a scale of stuff that we're going to be talking about here.
Yeah, so I mean, that's one of the interesting things. Both conversations I've had, when I say that, you know, they felt like they hit their limits, they've been working, both of the sites that I'm personally thinking of, have been working with WordPress for a really long time. Mm. And both of the individuals that I spoke to would say WordPress can scale. So it's not about whether it can. For them, it was about a particular part of their website. And these weren't like traditional content publishers.
They right, were just page like, views kind of.
Yeah, these were highly differentiated websites with a lot of custom stuff, technical stuff, and at some point maybe some poor architectural decisions either on their own or in the plugins that they rely on. So for a variety of reasons, it was the right move for them right now from an investment standpoint. But it doesn't mean that if they could go all over again that they wouldn't be able to architect things a little better or mitigate differently as they grow and things like that. So,
sure. It's about how easy it is to do that. And
right.
If, you know, there are so many obstacles to overcome, you're right that it can just make sense going with something else, which is going to be easier to do that. Because I guess at the end of the day, everything is infinitely scalable. It's just like, how much do you need to actually change the thing to achieve that? When you really kind of get down to basics.
So I figured we could go through some of the components of WordPress that are the most difficult to scale, or like the places you might run into first if you're trying to scale a website. Mm. So I think a key to understanding at least some of this would be to realizing the basics of posts and metadata and how querying works in WordPress. Because to me, one of the most common things you see is where someone's using posts, like, or the posts table for content that's not necessarily perfectly suitable for posts. And therefore they rely on metadata or potentially taxonomy data. But I feel like taxonomies in WordPress scale a little better than meta, especially in terms of querying. So what have you seen in terms of like the type of hiccups you can run into from a posts and meta standpoint?
Yeah, good question. I guess the opposite of a hiccup, I guess a common misconception with posts is kind of the amount of posts you have isn't necessarily a big limitation factor, right? It just kind of depends what you're doing with the posts typically. So it depends how you're querying for them and things like that. It's just those problems become bigger the more posts you have typically.
Mm-hmm. So a query that doesn't have a big speed impact with 10,000 posts might have a big speed impact with 100,000 posts or 500,000 posts.
Yeah, and like really what your the kind of thing that's affecting that performance is really the indexes on the database level. I guess for anybody that doesn't know, maybe a quick explanation of how that works. So essentially when you have your table, to take the post table, there's different columns on that table, like the ID or the post title or the post content, things like that. Any of those columns can have an index on them. In simple terms, that just means calculate when the post is created or whatever, the data in this column, so it's quicker to look up in the future. So if you take the post ID, because that's going to be indexed, so it's going to be really fast to look up a post by the ID. But if you take the post content field, that doesn't have an index on it. So if you try and say, get me posts that have exactly this content, then it's going to be slow because MySQL doesn't have an index on that. So then essentially what it has to do is look at every row one by one and do like a comparison on that on the post content field. So there's that's really the underlying side of WordPress, right, is the database and what is indexed and then what queries are you using when you use WP query and do those match to index data underneath or is it unindexed data? And one of the big problems with WP query is like as a user or developer with WordPress only working at the WP query level of abstraction without understanding exactly what indexes those are using underneath, then you're going to quickly kind of get into running really slow queries. So I think that's kind of an unfortunate thing, really, with WordPress development. It's really easy to not understand how the indexes are working underneath and therefore accidentally just do a really slow query because you queried by meta value when you could have only queried by meta key or something like that. The question is like, why not just index everything in the database? Because then everything will be quick to look up. But there is a trade-off there between one, more indexes means a lot more memory used for the database to store because the index fields are stored in very different ways. But it also just means slower queries everywhere. It's kind of like almost a priority list to say, I want this stuff to be faster and I'm okay with this being slower. And as we know from priorities, if you say everything is top priority one, then nothing is actually done any quicker. And it's kind of the same with database indexes. So that's why they're on, post content, for example, doesn't have an index because you don't really look things up by the content. It's also a very long value field, which makes the index, again, a lot more difficult.
What's the character limit on post content? It's insane.
It's very large. Yeah. Long text.
Because, you can have a 10,000 or a 50,000 word post in WP query. So if you have a index of that and you have a lot of instances of that, you, like you said, you lose
exactly.
You lose the benefits. An example of where you might end up with a lot of metadata per post, the classic ones in WordPress is e-commerce. Let's say you make an order a post, for instance. You could have a lot of order data that's not part of the post table, so then it goes into metadata for that post. So then when you're trying to look at reports of your orders and you're trying to query based on metadata, whether that's price or whatever other arbitrary values you're storing in meta, that's an example of where you're now querying posts or the orders by something that's not even in that same table. So you're doing a lot of cross-referencing and you're doing a lot of sorting and any particular WordPress post, depending on what all you're doing with it, you could end up with 50 or 100 pieces of metadata for one post. So if you have 100,000 of those, like say you have 100,000 orders with 100 pieces of metadata each, your 100,000 orders turns into 10,000 pieces of meta, or 10 million pieces of meta.
Right.
So that's why these meta tables end up getting very, very large. And then when you try to do anything with them, they become a mess. So your architecture for that then is really important. Unfortunately, some WordPress plugins that took advantage of WordPress's easy to use custom post type system did so early on. And now if they've had websites that are at a much larger scale, they're having to go back and turn those into custom tables and whatnot. Would you say that's is that a common thing that y'all have run into? Maybe not with e-commerce, but other types of stuff?
Yeah, it's so the storing the data in PostMatter isn't necessarily a problem. It's more like I was saying, like putting more data in just makes your existing queryings like problems even worse. So if anything, like you know, you can look at it at a nice way just to ensure that you're using a good database schema by putting loads of data in it, right? Kind of shows you that, because really you should be able to have millions of records in every table, and your website should still function fine. But yeah, so the problem is usually when plugins start looking up things by the post meta value, because there's no index on that meta value column because it's a long text column.
And if your key is take an order, if your key is price, then your value is whatever that price is.
Yeah.
So it's common. It's super common.
Yeah, no, it's not uncommon, because then you have a search form or something that says like, get me everything with less price than 50 or something.
Yeah.
And you can, you can imagine how that becomes very slow.
It's not saying let's get products that are less than $50. It's let's get orders that were less than $50. So if you have a big store, then that quickly becomes a disaster.
Yeah, yeah. And that is, I guess it's not necessarily the job of the metadata table, right, to be amazing at this, because it's not really built for that. It's maybe WordPress only has one content API, which is the custom post type API, really, realistically for most of the stuff. But there isn't much way to go a level deeper than that to really describe your objects in a more fundamental way to get all the querying stuff happening quickly. So it's very easy, for plugins or just, plugin authors that have made a plugin without the use case in mind of a really large site or something. And WordPress just doesn't advise you one way or the other in terms of its APIs and things like that. So querying by meta value is just kind of like a no-go anyway in any situation. So there's kind of some little tricks you can do to get around that. The one that I like the most is actually pushing data into your meta key column, which does have an index on it. So
how do you do that?
So let's say price is a slightly tricky example, because that is often a range-based thing. But let's presume that you want to get everything with a price of 50, and that was just something special on your site. You could add a meta value, a meta entry with price _50 to the post. So then you can do queries by that. So a better example is something that's binary, whether it's featured or not. A lot of people would do like a meta entry, which would be featured, and then it would have a value of like true or false, or 1 or 0 in the database. If you instead actually just rely on the existence of that key, the key doesn't exist when it's not featured, and it does exist when it is, it means you can do super fast querying just off the fact that that key does exist because there's an index on that column.
That's very clever.
Yeah, so that is that's one way you can get around it. Another, obviously, is like going the custom tables route. The problem with the reason why WordPress doesn't have a meta an index on meta value is because there's potentially could be a huge amount of data that goes into meta value. But if you are doing for your custom table, you're doing price, you know that the meta value in this case, if you're going to use meta, is always very small. It's a field that you could index if it weren't for WordPress just, wholesale saying meta can be of any value. So that's the problem with like not having a specific API to do that. So you could have a custom table that you added an index on for that. Another kind of really unrecommended thing would be to but I have done this before, is to add a index to meta value anyway.
So if you set your own rules for the site for what is allowed as a meta value, then
if you're in like a very controlled environment where maybe you know you're not using meta value for huge amounts of data or something specific like that, then I've definitely kind of gone the sledgehammer approach before.
I like your little meta key hack to be able to index that, but that mostly will work as long as whatever meta value, like the price 50 or, you know, the existence of the key, it's got to be pretty binary or numerical or like something simple. It can't be arbitrary content or data or information.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is, that's kind of has its limitations as well. But it's probably worth like saying, like, for a lot of stuff that where you want to do ranges and sorting based things, like of complicated rules like that, let's say you've got a front end search and you're doing, faceting on different things, you know, with your product database or something. MySQL is really not the best tool for the job, a lot of cases in that. Anyway, you might want to introduce some other layer for, you know, Elasticsearch or something on top of that to provide those things. So there's kind of no silver bullet for a lot of this stuff. That's kind of,
very good. I want to get into Elasticsearch in a little bit, but before we get off of querying, are there any other like kind of classic WP query parameters that someone could innocently use that end up being a pretty big disaster?
Yeah, certainly. Anything to do with search is a no-go. So using the query var for that.
I think it's S. Just
querying
S.
By title is not indexed either, post content either. A lot of stuff doesn't have indexes on, the majority. Dates can also be quite tricky. It's like, you know, if you have to do a slow query, try and, you know, cache it or something if you can. Another one I see a lot is when people do a WP query where they want to get, I don't know, let's say like your latest 5 posts and put it on your sidebar. You should always pass SQL found rows false, I think, or no SQL found rows true.
You mean when you're just throwing titles in there?
So if you're not using pagination, if you don't need to know that there are more posts than 7 available, then you can optimize the query because you don't need that select SQL found rows from the in the query, because you don't need to know how many more there are. So the query can stop at saying, you only wanted 5, I've got you 5, and I don't care how many more there are. By default, when you do a WP query, it will count the whole lot to give you pagination numbers.
So you do a full count of everything, even though you know you just want the first 5.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're not going to have pagination, there's a query var you can pass in, which I'm...
In addition to that, there's the caching parameters. So cache results you can set to false completely if you don't need any meta or term information, or you can do update post meta cache and update post term cache individually, and that prevents essentially just pulling in information from both term and meta tables into your WP query. So
yeah, because that's another thing that often people don't realize is doing a WP query also fetches all of the meta for all of those posts by default.
How many joins are there in a standard WP query?
So if you don't, if you're just passing like post type, say, there's none. But those extra meta ones are done one at a time with like clean meta cache or something for each post. So like the way WP query works is a little odd by default now. I think since the last few versions, it actually just pulls the IDs from the post table. And then it checks if all of those, if like one by one, if it's in the object cache. If it isn't, it goes and fetches them from the post table and pushes them to the object cache. So it's like done actually quite piece by piece now. It used to be done in one big go, but it's actually quicker. If you're going to query for 10 posts and 5 of them are already in the object cache, it only actually needs to fetch the data for 5 from the database. So it does like 2 trips for that.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know that. Yeah, be careful with your query parameters, and especially for those easy things, like tiny little queries, don't grab more than you need to. So become more accustomed to querying the bare minimum and then grabbing the individual pieces of data that you need.
Right.
I'm glad you mentioned that with the if you just need the like title of five posts, I mean, it should be a simple query. So while we're still on kind of posts and content, I guess let's skip users and traffic and stuff and go straight to search, like you said, because this is another way that I know WordPress.com does this. They're replacing a lot of queries with Elasticsearch. This is something that a number of big sites do these days. This is also how a lot of like related posts type of stuff that's more fuzzy matching. Is that what you would call that?
Yeah.
or anything kind of search related might use Elasticsearch. So can you kind of give us a introduction to like why Elasticsearch is better and what makes it considerably different from MySQL?
Yeah, I can attempt. So I guess MySQL is kind of like good at storing data with columns in a very, you know, tabular sense, as you kind of imagine. So if you want to retrieve things by exec values, huge amounts of data, then it's very good for that. It's also, you know, highly redundant. You don't lose stuff in your MySQL database. That is kind of like your source of all of the true data. So it's very robust because of that. It has things like transactions and, you know, lots of kind of enterprise grade stuff for good integrity, things like that. But it's not great at doing one. It's not very good at doing kind of fuzzy searching. So like it can do things like case insensitive search, but it doesn't get hugely more complicated than that. You can't search for "Hello, my name is." And your post actually says, "My name is comma hello" or something. It wouldn't be able to do anything like that. So kind of like the there are other tools available for that are very good for searching text and also doing other complicated faceting. And one of those, or probably the most popular currently, is Elasticsearch, which is an open source free piece of software, which is kind of it's essentially a different database engine, but the way that it's used with WordPress typically is it will kind of be an intermediary in between your MySQL database and WordPress for handling search queries for different things. So it will, when you update a post, it will both push it to Elasticsearch and push it to MySQL. And that means when somebody uses a search form on your site or something like that, then it'll instead search the Elasticsearch data to find all the posts in a very fuzzy way, and you can control weighting of like, I want posts that are more recent to have a certain weighting value. So if you search for a search term that isn't completely related to a really old post, you'll still get the later post first. You can do all this complicated kind of things. So it's really just a tool much better for that job of retrieving that fuzzy kind of data. So along comes with that is specifically in Elasticsearch, a thing called more like this, I think, query, which is essentially
like
which is essentially where the related posts for Jetpack or something like that come from. So that is saying, I have this post that's already in my Elasticsearch, and you can just tell Elasticsearch, get me ones that are similar in many ways to this one, and it will use a lot of heuristics basically to work that out based off the all of the fields, which other posts have more of those fields in common. You can say which fields, so you can say, give me posts where the title and the content is, or the post, the tags list or something is the most similar. And it is very quick. It's very scalable, and it will either, have it return you that data, or some plugins for Elasticsearch will just return you the post IDs, and then it will just go and get those posts from the MySQL database based off the ID. So that's then a super quick query.
To back up a little bit, Elasticsearch is a RESTful interface, right?
Yes, the way that works is an HTTP REST API.
And when you're using this, if you were using it with WordPress, you might use something like ElasticPress or your own implementation, whatever way you go. But ElasticPress, for instance, goes ahead and creates a Elasticsearch index for you. And this all, you'll have a separate Elasticsearch database where it kind of picks and chooses stuff from MySQL to put in Elasticsearch, index it, and make that available for all the things that Elasticsearch does.
Right.
So an example like you used, like we might say, okay, let's index all the titles and excerpts and content and, you know, the ID. And that way you can do these fuzzy searches. And I'm looking up this more like this API. So then you can say, let's take title and description. This is the thing they do. And then let's, you know, look into all these different things that we've indexed and find the, you know, find the ones that match. So then it uses their whole fancy API to find you the most relevant information, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. I think it's really good at replacing those like actual search queries. It's really good at doing complicated, drill downs of your content. So if you have a search form which has a lot of different attributes on it, where you have sliders for ranges of published dates or prices on your products, it's really quite good at doing those kind of queries as well. Because essentially what it is doing, it's a engine is like a NoSQL one, which means it doesn't have like tables. It just has for each post a big JSON object of all of the stuff to do with that post. So you kind of choose what that stuff is, but you could have, so on your post in Elasticsearch, it might have post title, post content, price, author, other things. So it will mush all of that data together. So that means you can do all of the faceting based off of that really quickly. So again, where it's not just the search query that you're doing in WP query, which is going to benefit from this. It's also if you're doing five tax queries and three meta queries with an and/or or something like that, which is going to be probably really slow using MySQL. It can be really good at speeding those things up again. So I think, like you mentioned, WordPress.com is offloading, more and more probably of the querying to the Elasticsearch level.
Are there MySQL queries that don't really make sense to offload to something like Elasticsearch?
I guess it's probably not a completely hard line, but I'd say like anything that's just naturally going to hit the indexes on your MySQL database, there's no value to doing that.
So like if you're just pulling IDs and then
right, exactly, or if you
arbitrary
getting your latest 10 posts or something doesn't really make sense.
So MySQL is perfectly good at, getting the essentials, and then you reference the object just like you ever would.
And it's also kind of worth noting that Elasticsearch is very basic, just in like the querying you can do. So like you can do all of those types of faceting, but let's say like MySQL has things like you can do calculations as part of the query and take those into account, or you can have procedures that you call on the data and then you can sort by those and things. So there's a lot of quite advanced stuff that you can do at the MySQL level as well. It's just WordPress doesn't leverage a huge amount of that. But I mean, I'd certainly be interested to see, if you had an Elasticsearch instance handling all of the querying, like literally everything, I'd like to just like see a side-by-side comparison with MySQL and that with
what happens
different types, and just kind of see what happens. The way that a bunch of the plugins work, I think there's ElasticPress by 10up, and then there is Ali Interactive have one called I want to say SearchPress, but it might not be. It's another coin of WordPress and Elasticsearch, but I can't remember which way around it goes.
We're real creative in the
Exactly. But the basic concept, anyway, is to use the same like you essentially have a class which maps WP query arguments to Elasticsearch queries. So the WP query one essentially does that for MySQL queries.
Yeah, there's this called ESWP query.
Okay, there we go.
So it's theirs is a full drop-in replacement for WP Query. So that would actually be, it'd be interesting to take a site. So like if we took PostStatus, for instance, we could, create two staging sites, one with MySQL and one with an ElasticPress server, and do comparative queries, see where it improves significantly and see
right,
if it fails.
Right, exactly.
I want to do it. Who wants to do it for me?
sweet.
If I say I want to do it, I don't want to do it.
Right. You want it to
I
be
just
done.
I want it to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's worth saying that you're like, once you're getting to, I don't know, a store of, you know, I don't know, thousands of products, you're going to really be looking at introducing something like this. Or if you just want search that doesn't suck. The thing is, like, MySQL just can't do good search. So if you have a fair amount of content and you want your search experience to actually be useful rather than, you know,
yeah,
quick is one thing.
On posters.
Right. Yeah, you probably got to spell things exactly right and things like that. So, yeah, kind of.
So that kind of gets as far as we have time for in terms of posts and meta and so and general querying and WordPress and the to TLDR some of that. It would be to analyze your base level architecture and the architecture of plugins that you're using. And it's worth noting a lot of the plugins out there, the ones that come to mind because they're sharing about how they're fixing things are WooCommerce and Easy Digital Downloads. Those come to mind to me because they're both working on like taking that example, like getting orders into their own tables and having their own indexes.
I guess they're kind of two plugins that are probably quite going to be used often on fairly large sites as well. So I think you see just
right.
bias because of that.
Yeah, because it's not scale based on like having 100,000 blog posts. It's based on how many people are buying stuff off of a particular website. So as a website grows, their customers have started to run into these problems and they're, you know, troubleshooting them over time and trying to manage backward compatibility while they update them and do these big data migrations. So like the one for WooThemes is scheduled for WooCommerce 3.0, which is several releases off, and it's like this it's a massive project. I can't imagine what it's going to be like when that actually comes out. And it's like, okay, we're going to pull the trigger on moving all your orders into this completely new architecture. I hope they are going to be helping people take snapshots of their database ahead of time.
Yeah.
That sounds terrifying. Anyway, so... And one of the reasons, this isn't like people made these awful decisions in the first place. It's just what happened was people were taking advantage of what WordPress gave you for free. For instance, like a lot of the functions available in WordPress that query data for you, they're made available when you're using the posts table, but not so much in custom tables. So what they're doing now is they're kind of mapping a lot of the familiar functions that people are used to using in WordPress. And they're mapping them to their custom tables and to their custom functionality so that the developer that's working with these plugins has a similar experience, but it's not querying, it's not actually querying posts and meta. It's querying, you know, their whole new architecture that they're building.
I guess that's a general, you know, I guess like when you're building something like WooCommerce from the beginning, then you don't need it to be, you know, off the bat incredibly scalable. Like there's you need a certain level of success, I guess, before you get to that. So I don't think it's surprising that we hit into these limitations at some point down the road. It's in many ways like a good problem to have. So what's kind of important is it's still possible to kind of move further, that you're not completely painted into a corner. I dare say WooCommerce is having to do a fair bit of work though to get out of that one.
I mean, if they were a hosted system, it would have been easy. But since they are managing backwards compatibility, it's not easy. Okay, I want to spend a few minutes on users because it's got some unique issues. I'm not sure if you've dealt much with this, but I have a couple things on my mind. But first, I want to know what your experience is in that regard.
I wouldn't say I've had a huge problem with users. But it does, I guess, depending what way you're using them. One thing that comes to mind is multi-site, because your users are shared across all of the sites. That's something you do need to watch out for.
And specifically the one that comes to mind for me, because for the record, I mean, users, the architecture of users in WordPress isn't that dissimilar from posts in the sense of there's user and there's user meta. Although people aren't going to typically abuse user meta as much. And I say that there's always exceptions. But in the admin, people run into issues with users pretty frequently. So if you have everyone that subscribes to your website, for instance, then your users table can scale with the size of your website's visibility. If you just have registered users.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're in the admin and you're like, an example someone used with me the other day, and I've had this before too. If you're going to say delete a user, or you're just trying to go view an archive of the users, the one to go delete a user, at least in the past, I think it still is, you hit the drop down and it tries to show you all users on your website. So WordPress is trying to load 300,000 users or whatever on that page so that you can do a drop down and find the person that you want to delete. So that fails pretty miserably.
Yeah, no, it fails a couple of levels. I think also if you try and delete a user on multi-site, it doesn't have drop downs per site that user has posts on. So it's even worse.
Yeah, and there are some people that have done multi-site adjustments. Well, one, Jeremy Felt has really driven home trying to fix this across multi-site. But also, like, there's people that have made these adjustments, and I need to find one, because you can essentially look at every instance of something like this, and someone's fixed it in to a degree, either by not automatically loading it and turning it into some sort of like API, you know, like, I don't know, select to type of interface, where you just get it based on what you're looking for in the search or something, or just turned it off so that you can load the pages where you run into that type of stuff. I can't think of any other like big scaling issues with users, but I know that's certainly one. Like when you get into that many users, you run into some serious admin problems.
Yeah. The other one that I know of is the user session stuff that went in WordPress 4.3, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is basically when anybody logs into your website, they get a cookie that says they're logged in, but it also stores in the database by default what that user's valid cookie sessions are, essentially. So that means you can invalidate those sessions, and even if somebody has a logged in cookie, they still can't access the site, which is a great feature. The problem is that if you have a huge amount of users logging into your site all the time, it can cause a lot of stampeding on the database with insert or update queries to your user meta. I hope I'm correct on this. I'm pretty sure if you're using a persistent object cache like Memcached, then they're stored in Memcached. If that's not true, there is a define, I think, to turn that on.
Still can be an issue in some circumstances, though. One of the sites that I was talking to somebody about, they have several hundred thousand users, and sessions was one of the places where it was failing for them. However, this is a courseware type of site, so active users logging in and actually doing stuff was pretty important.
Mm.
That number was actually a lot smaller than you would think, though, because even though you may have 500,000 users, a lot of sites aren't going to have more than, you know, several tens of thousands of active users.
Right.
But even at that level, say 20 or whatever thousand active users, the session stuff was still a problem for them.
Mm. Interesting.
So another thing to consider, and I'm sure there are ways to get around that, but it can be troublesome. All right. What about traffic more generally, like just scaling traffic and hosting, and I guess we'd get into caching here. I would assume this is where you have most of your experience in terms of scaling WordPress.
Probably, yeah. Like, I think this hosting is probably one that takes the most effort to get right, is all the stuff that we've talked about. Like, even if you have slow queries that take 3 seconds aren't a huge problem until you have 100 people trying to make that query at the same time. So traffic is another just like compounding factor for most things that just, you know, will make any bottlenecks even, you know, much worse.
More bottlenecky.
More bottlenecky. Yeah.
Just explode.
Exactly. So there is there's a few ways, I guess, that you can deal with that. Like WordPress, when you go download WordPress and you put it on your host or whatever, you put it anywhere, it is by default very slow. And there are several things that you need to do to speed it up, unfortunately. So the probably the most important one, or there's a couple that you're going to need. One is you want a persistent object cache, so you need something like Memcached or Redis or APCU or something like that to use as the object cache drop-in, that's called. So
do you have a preference?
We use Memcached. So there's like the three main ones are APCU, which is the PHP inbuilt one, which is really fast, but will only work if you've got a single server. If you have multiple web servers, then you can't use that option anymore. So then it's really Redis or Memcached. Memcached is a little more battle-tested, though Redis is pretty good. I know Pantheon use Redis, but most of the other hosts are using Memcached, I think. So the basic principle here is instead of, like, WordPress is built like throughout the whole code base to try and take stuff from your persistent object cache instead of the database directly. So
for more layman folk, can you explain what that means in terms of grabbing it in memory rather than?
Yeah. So let's say you are viewing a post and you know the ID is 100 or something. You can go and fetch that from the database and bring it back and then show the post on the page. So taking the trip to the database and transferring that data back is quite an expensive thing for the MySQL server to do, even though it's quite a quick query. If there's loads of other queries happening, if the table is locked because something else is updating a post, so it won't let you fetch other posts whilst that post is updating. So it's just considered quite an expensive thing to do in terms of, you know, computer time and performance. So if you basically have this intermediary, which is your persistent object cache, where WordPress will say, let's try and get it from the object cache. And if it isn't there, then we'll go back to the database and fetch the data. And while we're at it, we'll also push it into the object cache so it's there for next time. So throughout WP query and PostMeta and all of these things are stored in the object cache. So if you're not using a persistent object cache, which WordPress doesn't have configured by default out of the box, it's just storing it like in the memory of the PHP process, which is wiped out every time a new page is rendered. So that only kind of, let's say you call a get option twice in your code. One line, you know, you're doing get option site URL, and line two, you're doing get option site URL. The second one isn't going to go back to the database because WordPress is going to keep it in memory because it already fetched the options from the database on line one. So the adding the persistence level with something like Memcache just means like when somebody else views a different page and on line one, that one says get option site URL. It's already going to be in the object cache because the object cache is shared between the two pages in that case.
And since it's at the server level, it doesn't matter who's making these calls. You take advantage of it no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. So like because of that, once your cache is kind of warmed, as in like there's quite a lot in your object cache, everybody visiting your site gets a faster experience because it's always already there.
You said the phrase for that is getting it warm.
Yeah, it's like, if you're like running your website hot, that's to say like there's a lot of traffic on it. So it's like keeping all the cache fresh.
If you're about to launch something that's high traffic and it's never been visited before, you might want to go like poke around it a little bit.
literally just doing that because the problem you have is called a stampede typically. So if you like publish a new post but nobody has gone to look at it yet, and then let's say...
And then it auto-tweets it?
Yeah, then you auto-tweet it and I don't know, somehow you have millions of followers and you get... 200 people come in the first second before the page has actually been responded to anybody, then it's going to be doing all of that stuff in parallel. So it's going to go to the database for each of those people. So if you only had one person go initially, it would have got the cache and then it'd been fast for everybody, but instead it might take down your server or something.
Neat.
Yeah. So that's kind of persistent object caching. So that's like the first thing that you need to get set up. I would say.
And that's the type of thing that I guess some shared hosts might do this now too, but definitely the managed hosts are taking.
Yeah, so I don't know of any managed host now that doesn't already have that. So if you're on...
they're not a managed host if they don't do that.
Yeah, pretty much. then like the usual sledgehammer that you apply after your object cache is a page cache via Varnish or something Nginx or something like that.
So your object cache is purely data driven. It's not actually the view, like the actual web page that you're going to look at.
So right. So PHP is still running everything in the object cache example, and it's also worth noting that your object cache isn't like that is a exact replica of what is your in your database. So you shouldn't ever have to actually delete any of your object cache. If you do, then it means something has done something wrong. Whereas with what we're going to talk about now, page caching, that isn't true. So the page cache is, you know, somebody comes to visit your web page and all of the HTML that is output because of that, then you just put that in a cache, like at a level in front of WordPress, typically. So there are
literally a lot of times, or maybe all the time, that literally ends up being a file, an HTML file.
Yeah, you can kind of think of it that way, because you know the next time somebody requests that the homepage of your website, it's just getting that HTML file. There is no PHP, there's no WordPress or anything like that being involved. So that is it's kind of considered the sledgehammer because that is a cache which can potentially have invalid stuff. So if you updated your post, but you've got some cache server in front that is you know. Going to serve that cache for 5 minutes or something, then your update isn't going to go live until that cache is expired.
Unless your caching system knows that when you update a post or whatever, that it automatically busts affected.
Yeah, so that's the usual ways to do caching validation on the with front end caching, but it's not ideal. Like you can. When you publish a post, you can say flush the homepage cache, but maybe you would also want to flush all the category pages that it's on. Maybe you'd also want to flush the author page. So it's a pretty much unsolved computer science problem to be able to invalidate every cache that you need to when you update something.
So depending on what you update, it could get funky. So like,
yeah, it can have
if you update the title text, for instance, that would be difficult to invalidate smartly because the title could appear quickly all over the website.
Yeah, maybe you have like related post widgets on different pages or something like that, and you know they show that
recent posts or whatever. But if you're let's say you only show the full content, you know, aside from the excerpt, you only show the full content of the post on the post page, then updating the at least the single view page cache, you should be able to take care of it, bust the single page.
Yeah, though you've got to also think about things like your RSS feeds can be, depending if people use those, the REST API is another thing to consider. That's like, there's usually an accepted, you know, most companies accept that there is some time to live for when they publish content. And that being 5 minutes, some people are okay with. So that's kind of just, you know, part of the course, really, if you want to do a huge amount of traffic and not be super smart about that, is you can just like put a really good caching level in between. But there's a lot of tweaking you can do there. Like a common problem is marketing running campaigns and adding like query parameters to the URLs to be able to track where all the traffic is coming from. So that can actually generate a huge amount of different URLs for technically the same piece of content.
And they're not any good at they create a new cache for each one of those.
So that's typically what will happen by default because UTME source or whatever the Google one is. Typically you want your cache to be different if it's got different GET query params on it because somebody might be purposefully, you know, maybe you submit a form and when like you redirect back, you do like ? Submitted equals one, and then you want to show a success message, say thank you for your submission. So in this case, you do want a different cache. So there's a lot of, like, you can tweak with things like Varnish, like which query params are included in the cache, things like that. So when you're really getting to the high end, you're really trying to, if you're using the page cache, you're aiming to get as high a hit rate as possible, which means the percentage of people that are viewing your website are actually getting just cache pages. That's kind of the best metric. So if you're getting 95% hit rate, then you're doing pretty good in terms of offloading a lot of the amount of requests coming through to WordPress itself, which means if you do have some slow queries and things, maybe you can get away with having those a little slow because you're not getting a torrent of traffic through. This is probably 2% of the things that you can do.
I want to get into dynamic data and scaling traffic in just a second. But before we do that, I want to say thank you to iThemes for being a WordPress partner, a PostStatus partner. iThemes has been a supporter of PostStatus since the very beginning, and I'm proud that they are a partner. You can go to iThemes.com to check them out. They have a variety of products that you might be interested in. Backup Buddy is their longstanding backup solution, and they actually have Backup Buddy Stash Live now that's more like a live snapshot of your website. And then you can also check out iThemes Security Pro to harden your website. And then some things that you may not know less about but are no less impressive are iThemes Sync, which is a place to manage all your WordPress websites from one spot. You can even do like client-generated reports and stuff based on updates that you've run and activity on that website. And then iThemes Exchange, we've been talking about e-commerce. iThemes Exchange attempts to be the simplest WordPress e-commerce platform out there. They've really gone all in on making it a great membership e-commerce setup as well. It's really good, really simple, really easy to set up. Go check out everything at iThemes.com, and thanks for iThemes for being a PostStatus partner. All right. I want to know a little bit more about the dynamic data within a full-page cache. How do you do that?
So the problem here is if you want the best example is when users are logged into your website, you typically don't want to give them a static page cache because maybe you have like a bar along the top of your site which says like "Welcome Joe" or something. So you can't use the same page for everybody that visits the website. So that will, if like everybody on your website is a logged in user and you're not serving them flat page cache, you're now not getting any, you know, a high cache hit rate. So you're getting loads of load on your server again. So kind of the next best line of defense for this is to just have sections within the page that are cached and then some of them aren't cached. So to do caching at this level, you've got to really, without getting very tricky anyway, you've got to like go back to the PHP WordPress level of caching. So you have to, you know, essentially, for WordPress people, you logged in people, you'll ignore them from your front end cache, and all those people will come back to WordPress. But when WordPress is rendering the page, there's maybe your whole menu or something, and the content of the page in terms of like your post content isn't different per user. So you can do a thing called fragment caching for those, where essentially you're looking at your pages and caching everything that isn't going to change for different people. And a nice side effect of that is if you do something like you cache your sidebar widgets or something, then when they're viewed on any different page, if you're going to use the same widgets, then they don't also need to change. So you can share the cache between those pages. So it can actually be much quicker in some regards to take this approach where you're, again, like warming up your cache of different components that you're caching on your page. So then pages that have never been viewed before are still actually relatively quick to load because there's only a few things that's unique to those pages. Really, if you, you know, compare the HTML output of two different post pages, probably 80% of that is exactly the same. So the way that you usually implement caching at this level is like the fragment static HTML caching is you'll use your WordPress persistent object cache to store those HTML fragments in. So there's a couple of plugins that can help you with that. I think Rust has one for fragment caching. Forget what it's called.
It's called fragment cache.
There we go.
I was wondering if you knew of another one because Rust is the only one that I really know of.
Yeah. So there is one called HM fragment cache, which is a human made, just basic code level one for essentially you can. There's a different function called hmgetTemplatePart, which will also handle caching for that template part based off of the variables that you pass to it. So you can, you know, just have your normal post loop of, you know, getTemplatePart with the, you know, when you pass it in your template part, but instead you'll just use hmgetTemplatePart and pass it the post ID, and then it will automatically cache, you know, all of those different post list items.
This is a single file drop-in, it looks like.
Yeah, it's very, very quite simple. a really kind of common thing to fragment cache, if you can, is your WordPress menus. And that can depend if you have, like, if you're highlighting the current page in your menu, then you can't really cache it anymore because, you know, it needs to be different for every page. But if it isn't, like, your footer menu often won't be. WordPress menus are, unfortunately, incredibly slow. They use posts of two post types underneath. So using WP queries, which aren't object cached, like the main WP query. So those are slow, so I definitely recommend wrapping those up in fragment cache if you can. Any kind of related post widgets, things like that, if they're going to be the same for the current category, then you could fragment cache it based off the category that you're viewing. A nice little handy thing actually in the HM fragment cache plugin is you can set this define in your config, and then like when you view your page, it will show in green everything that like hit the cache. And will show red for anything that didn't. So as you're kind of like browsing around your site in development mode, you can see which areas are getting cached and which aren't. So that can be quite useful. Like ideally speaking, you could maybe like cut down the amount of if you get cache hits on all of your fragments, then maybe you're speeding up the page by 80% or something like that. So it can make a really big difference. Especially like fragment caching the more expensive areas obviously makes a bigger difference, but it's a good practice. Even if you're using a front end cache like Varnish, then it's still a really good practice for those URLs that haven't already been viewed. Because if you have a site of like 80,000 posts that only get a few views each, like maybe you're auto generating content and you've got some SEO campaign or something that is like, It's all kind of like an automatically run website, right, where you're going for low traffic on a huge amount of URLs. Doing caching with page caching isn't really going to help you because all of your different traffic is just spread across so many different pages. But fragment caching is going to help you because you're going to like, 80% of every page view is going to be made up of cached data. So it's going to be relatively fast across the board. And that's kind of the, I'd say that's kind of the holy grail, I think, is... to be able to disable page caching on the front and survive just with object caching and fragment caching, because then like really all of your pages are fundamentally dynamic and you don't have to worry about cache invalidation so much. You can have instant publishing things and stuff like that. So you can really get your site running quickly that way if you have, you know, covered all of your bases on what you're caching. The reason kind of page caching is so popular is just because it's, you know, you don't really have to worry about if the page takes 3 seconds just to load because there's something hooked in, like in init that's going to slow down every page load or something. Front-end caching is still going to cover over that problem. So really it's a way to paste over your problems rather than solving them in a lot of cases. So it's good to be able to get a really fast site with a lot of traffic without that front page cache and rely on the object cache, MySQL cache, and fragment caching things. And then you can still have a page cache because you never know, you know, maybe you're going to get 20,000 active users on your site when you didn't expect it or something, and it can really kick in and help that. But it's good not to kind of add that level too early and obstruct over issues underneath that you may not be privy to.
So how do people manage data that's always dynamic with a full page cache? Like take something like advertising is a kind of classic example. How do you deliver ads and utilize a full page cache at the same time?
Yeah. So the way that this, you know, if you're delivering your own ads, then and you're doing the logic for who is seeing which ads, that's is that the use case you're talking about there, really?
Well, I don't know. I mean, so on PostStatus, I was worried about this because I had no idea what the best way around it was. So I kind of took every route possible. So I ended up putting them in an iframe.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And I also, I'm under the impression now I can be stupid and on the podcast. So.
You can pretend you're playing that role just for the benefit of listeners.
Yeah, just pretending. Could I use the REST API, for instance, and dynamically change the ad for every page view, but maintain a full page cache where essentially operating in JavaScript on top of the full page cache.
Yeah, so you definitely technically could do that, but you need to be aware that you are technically loading WordPress for every visitor to your website still. So this is actually, like, when I'm doing performance reviews, quite often the page load itself is fine, and that's not many queries, but like if every page load causes an admin AJAX request to get your latest posts or something like that, then you've just kind of like shifted all of the load to a different part there. But loading something like one post through the REST API is certainly going to be a lot quicker than having to like render that page with no static page cache. So I would say that's going to be better, but it's still not going to be perfect. Really, there are... there's other things that you could look at. It really depends. But let's say you have 10 advertisements, which are going to, I don't know, let's just say you're randomly showing them to different people. And you've got your REST API endpoint that is going to randomly return a different ad for when anybody views it. Instead of doing that, you'd probably be better off just like in JavaScript, having the 10 ads, their URLs already in JavaScript and doing that calculation in JavaScript using, you know, some random thing there.
So load all 10.
Right.
Put them in the cache and then use JavaScript to just show one.
Yeah, exactly. So it depends on the use case for that. But again, like the more front end stuff you can do there where you're leveraging, you're really like allowing people's browsers to all do that thing themselves rather than your server having to do everything for everybody, then you could take that approach.
Well, if you'll excuse me, I need to go change some code. I only call one. Otherwise, I do exactly that, but I only call the one. But that's way smarter. I've always wondered what exactly I was causing problems with in terms of, you know, if I had true performance issues. You know, unfortunately, I don't really run into scale issues very often, if ever.
Because of your great host, right?
Yeah, because of my great host, not because I don't get very much traffic. Right. But the advertising is always the one that, you know, confuses me. And I know it does slow down a lot of websites, but, you know, a lot of websites out there are running advertising and full-page caches, right?
Yeah, so the way that most ad tags are working, like if you've just got like DoubleClick or something like that, then you typically just manage all of the segmentation and targeting from the advertiser dashboard. So take DFP, which is, I think, the most popular. So let's say you want to like target a specific category or something like that. Like you're best off just using a single ad tag on your website and passing the, you know, custom variables to that based in the page, so you can like pass the categories through to DFP through that ad tag, and then you just like use DFP's dashboard to do all of your different targeting for different things. So that's probably actually what like I do in your case. So every user has the same HTML, right, which has a JavaScript file from DFP that's going to go to DFP and say which ad should I show to this user, and then through DFP. You know, you're kind of essentially offloading the problem to them to serve different content to different people. But the content on your website is exactly the same. So even for your own internal ads, then you could potentially use something like DFP for that. Like
I have to look up what DFP
is. Oh, so that DoubleClick for Publishers, which is actually now owned by Google, which is just like pretty much 90% of online, advertising runs through DFP. So that's like that horrible dashboard that's incredibly complicated to use to manage your ad tags. That's DFP.
Yeah, there has to be a better way.
Yeah, well, we'll run away and start a start an actual good advertising technology.
Trust me, this has been on my mind. Not for doing complex stuff like that, but like for just basic ad delivery.
Right.
I feel like there's a little room for disruption there. Just
space. Web advertising, like, generally. That, I mean, maybe we'll do a podcast on that one day because I've got a lot of things to say there.
Well, I fear that we are going to reach our limit here in terms of scaling this podcast. Excuse me, dad joke. I think we could go significantly further, but I would like to finish just kind of by saying, do you think there are some there's some baseline data where you would start to get concerned about WordPress's capability? Like, can you throw out some numbers? Like, well, if you have if you expect more than, you know, a million posts or half a million users or whatever kind of number, would you be comfortable throwing out any type of number? Like if you were bidding a job or something?
Yeah, the like I said earlier, like the number of content or the amount of content doesn't really matter. Like we've definitely done sites with millions of posts. That's fairly like that's there's no problem there. Really around concurrency and the amount of people doing things is really the biggest bottlenecks that we see. And increasingly so, that is the bottleneck of like content publishers and editors. So if you have a site that has, maybe they have 200 people that can write content for them. 200 people in the admin of your site publishing content is actually a really difficult thing to scale because the WordPress, like as you realize when people say WordPress can scale, you know, VIP or something like that, WordPress.com VIP, most of that kind of scaling is really around caching of viewing data. When you start introducing a lot of real-time stuff, like people publishing content all the time, you know, 50 posts going up an hour or something is much more difficult to handle, both in terms of just like all of the write queries that because of that, you know, publishing a post in the admin causes a huge amount of data to be deleted from your cache and things. It's really not optimized in this regard yet. You know, I think it's probably going to take a couple of years before those kind of flows, like the and using the admin is really well optimized, like the front end is now. So you can get into a problem there with hundreds of editorial, like teams of hundreds of people trying to log in and all doing stuff. Also stuff where you're wanting like a high amount of real-time data, which is why, like I say, WordPress isn't great as like a chat backend or something, because there's a huge amount of updates and reads, and you need it to be consistent. You can't just like cache the messages in a chat for 5 minutes. That doesn't really work. I think Nomad Base is probably the thing that we have that's closest to that, where there's thousands of people all changing their locations quite often, or at least we're getting new data on, you know, an existing location that they're in. They check in somewhere else just down the street. There's a lot of data coming in, so we're having to use custom tables for a lot of that stuff, because just something like WP delete post can take like over a second to run, even, you know, because you're taking time to delete things and look other things up, checking if you need to delete them, things like that. WP insert post, again, even with like all of the caching, the best you can have, like you're probably not going to be inserting posts if you don't turn off things like term count deferring and all of that to like better than a second or something. So if you're churning in a huge amount of content, and again, like all of these problems are fixable, but there's no denying that WordPress isn't great about this off the bat. And hopefully just the more WordPress is used for those use cases, you know, with a lot more content being created simultaneously. Because WordPress, running WordPress in parallel, again, you know, when you have two people literally do something exactly the same time, things can go really wrong. I think WordPress needs to mature a little more in that regard.
Or we just rewrite it in like Node.
Yeah, without going too crazy, whereas you're going to basically have a different system that we just share the name of WordPress with this previous PHP piece of software. There's probably some way that we can go a fair bit further with the technology that we have. It's more just need more people to help out with you know, those use cases. And like as WordPress is getting more into large sites, enterprisey stuff where these things are more required, then the better it becomes at that, because we create GitHub, I wish we create GitHub issues. We create track tickets you know, make those problems known, and then people fix them, work on them, and things get better. So I think the latest version of WordPress that it will be out, that I think was in Release Canada today, 4.6, now finally comments are stored in your persistent object cache, so all of the comment type stuff is much faster than it used to be. It wasn't long ago, though we didn't talk about it today, that having 1,000 posts on your site on a post was a really big problem, both in terms of people creating those comments very quickly, but also just reading all of those back was super slow. So it's getting there. There's just definitely more to be done, and there's more I think that could be done both out of the box and just with easier to drop in solutions to kind of solve those problems as well.
Cool. Softball of the century. If people need scaling help with their WordPress installs, who should they call?
I mean, it make your mind up after listening to this podcast. You could call us, but
yeah,
I guess my recommendation is like do some research into it yourself. Actually,
I was joking. I was just going to tell people to go to HumanMade.
I can't possibly even in a joke call out, you know, give myself a plug.
Yeah. Well, that was the point, because this is us signing off the podcast, so this was your chance to plug.
Oh, yeah, you can tweet me, @_Hoyle. Yeah. Just say my site is slow, and...
Just say my site is slow, help.
Help me.
Yeah. Or better yet, do it at Tom Wilmot.
Yeah, that's true. It may actually be more fruitful than doing it to me, so...
All right, so you can find Joe at @Joe_Hoyle. Or joehoyle.co.uk. You can check out his website that scales very well.
It does, actually. If you can take my website down for visits, I'll be pretty impressed.
Yeah. And then go to poststatus.com and join and stuff like that. And we'll see y'all next time. Thanks.
Cheers.